Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Good afternoon, everyone. I feel a bit like a pop singer with this strange microphone. But don't worry, I'm not going to sing. I'm going to talk to you about the in-memory OLTP feature that we're shipping with SQL Server 2014. And I'm going to look at it through a DBA lens, talk about particular concerns for database administrators using this feature. Now, I want to make one thing perfectly clear from the start. This feature is not a workaround for developers writing bad queries. If your developers are using T-SQL cursors, using too many temp tables, too many outer joins, dynamic SQL, that's not going to be a replacement, I'm sorry. If you take a bad query, you put an efficient storage engine underneath, it's still a bad query and will still perform badly. So my name is Jos de Bruin. I'm a program manager on the SQL Server team. I've been working on this feature for the last couple of years. So I want to talk about what it means for DBAs and how you should, as a DBA, think about applications that are using this feature on your servers. Now, can you give me a show of hands who attended the developer focus session yesterday? About half, okay. So there are some aspects which I covered in a developer focus session yesterday, which are also kind of relevant to DBAs, which I will only touch on slightly in this talk, but I would then, if you want to learn more, I encourage you to review the developer focus session. The video will be online and the slides will be available as well. So, first, I want to just give a very quick recap to make sure we all have the right context about what this feature is. By the way, I'm walking a little bit off the podium here. I hope you don't mind, because when I'm standing on the podium, I have these spotlights shining in my eyes. And I will be squinting and looking angry, and I'm sure you don't want to see that. So, the in-memory OLTP feature is a performance feature for OLTP workloads. We want to optimize the performance of OLTP workloads by using the abundant memory that you have in your servers. So there are four key pillars to this technology. So first off, we have memory-optimized table and index structures. So data is not organized in pages. No, rows are the atomic unit, and rows are always addressed through 8-byte memory pointers. That's the way we navigate through memory. You can always address every row directly through this 8-byte pointer. No need to navigate a tree, to navigate pages, to navigate files. That's all not necessary because everything is in memory. Which brings me to the next point. Everything is in memory. All your data needs to fit in memory. In addition, all your indexes need to fit in memory. But the indexes exist only in memory. So indexes do not have a representation on disk. They are not written to disk. Index operations are not logged in the transaction log. And now because we use memory as the main storage for the rows, the persistence mechanism that we have, because we do have persistence, the persistence mechanism that we have does not need to use pages and does not need to write to random places on the disk. Instead, we can use stream-based storage. We optimize for sequential I.O. And I will go into a bit of detail what that means exactly. Second pillar is native compilation of business logic. So we take T-SQL stored procedures and compile those to native code. We compile them to DLLs, which are linked directly into the SQL Server process for very efficient query execution. And yeah, I will not go into much detail on this pillar in this session. As a DBA, you could be concerned here about the amount of memory used by execution of these stored procedures and, for example, runaway database owners that start to create thousands and thousands of stored procedures. Those are things you want to look out for, but I will not go into detail about that in this session. Third, we optimize for highly concurrent workloads. and therefore we use latch and lock-free data structures. And to guarantee consistency between different threads that are trying to access the same rows, we use two mechanisms. We use multi-versioning, and the multi-versioning is built into the table structures. That's an important point to keep in mind when you think about how much memory you need, because you don't only need to store the rows that are visible at the moment, but you also need to store the row versions that are required by the running transactions. The second thing, which is more of a developer concern, is that if there is a conflict between two writers, if two writers want to write to the same row, one of them will win, the other one will fail, and will need to retry the transaction. But it's something developers can deal with. Fourth, very important point, our main value proposition of the feature is that it is fully integrated into SQL Server, which means that you will be able to use the same familiar management tools that you have been using all along, like SSMS, SMO, PowerShell scripting, and we are providing a new set of DMVs which give you insight into what the system is doing, and I will give you some examples in the demos that I have for you. So what are the main DBA concerns I want to talk about? The first one is memory. So how much memory do you need, and how do you manage this memory? Second is the on-disk storage. Even though it is an in-memory feature, we have persistence on disk to make sure that your data will survive server crash or always on failover. So first, the memory. So we have new in-memory data structures. So we have a completely new row format where the structure is optimized for in-memory access and residency. And also, we have only one copy of each row. So indexes do not contain copies of any part of the data in the row. We don't have, for example, a concept of included columns. And even the hash indexes, which I will show you later on, they don't even have a copy of the primary key. They just contain pointers, direct pointers to the row. This also means that every index is covering. They virtually include every column, but still we have only one copy of every row. As for indexes, we have two types of indexes. One of them is available in CTP1. The other one will become available also in CTP2. So we have hash indexes, which is the one that's now available now, which is particularly suited for point lookups. If you want to do an equality seek, hash indexes will give you the best performance, because in the ideal case, you need only two hops to get to your row instead of needing to navigate a whole tree. And then second, we have the non-clustered indexes for memory-optimized tables. They look a little bit like B-trees, but they are not exactly the same. For example, they don't have fixed length pages. They have variable size pages, and they are self-maintaining, so you don't need to do any reorganizing or rebuilding or anything like that. But I will not go into too much detail about those. Those are coming in CTP2, and we'll have more details about these indexes around that time. So we'll focus for now mostly on the hash indexes. And these indexes, they all do not exist on disk. This means that we don't need to log any inserts or any index maintenance operations, anything like that. And we also don't need to load indexes from disk during recovery. Instead, we build these indexes on the fly during recovery. And it turns out that this brings very little overhead. It is still the I/O is going to be the driving force behind the recovery time. More about that later also. So a row will look a little bit like this. You have a row header and a payload, which is the row data. These are your columns. And also this will include things like the null bitmap and the locations of variable size columns, etc. The row header will have a begin and end timestamp, which determine when this row is going to be visible. If it's, for example, between 100 and 200, then every transaction with a timestamp between those two times can access this row. We also have a statement ID, which I will not go into that much detail, and we have a number of index links. So for every index in the table, there is an index link in the row header. And this index link always points to the next row in that same bucket, if you're talking about a hash index. I think I covered most of the things here. Yeah. So yeah, to reiterate, we don't have any data or index pages. We just have rows here. Now, this is an example of a table with two hash indexes. I covered this example in a little bit more detail in the developer focus session yesterday, the DBI B307. So if you have not seen that, I encourage you to look it up, at least the portion where I cover this. But what I do want to highlight or reiterate here is that we have a number of rows which just exist in memory, not in any particular structure. Well, we have some internal structures, of course, to keep track of things, but those are not really relevant. Then we have like the timestamp and the pointers, that's like the header, and then we have the payload. In this example, we have two columns in the payload. And we have in this example two hash indexes, one on name, one on city. And the hash index consists of a number of buckets. And each hash bucket is just an 8-byte memory pointer to the first row in that bucket. So for example, this slot 0 of my hash index contains one row, which is Jane in Prague. Similarly for this slot 2 and slot 4. If I look at this slot 2 of my hash index on city, this one has two rows. So the first one is Jane Prague, and then Jane Prague contains a pointer to the second row in that bucket, which is John Prague. And now, if you have, for example, a delete operation will just mark a row as not visible as of a particular time. So, for example, this row, Susan Bogota, is no longer visible as of time 150. So at time 150, a transaction came in and deleted this row. An insert just puts another row in a particular bucket. And an update is always going to be a delete followed by an insert. So if I would, for example, update this row John Prague, I would delete this original row by writing an end timestamp and insert a new row here. So this is roughly what the structure looks like. A few key things to keep in mind here is that you always need indexes to get to your rows. Those are the basic entry points. You cannot do a table scan without an index. In fact, we don't support table scan as such. Right? We always do an index scan if you want to get to your rows. Second, these hash indexes, they are always fixed length. You need to specify a bucket count when you create the index, and it's always going to have this number of buckets. Those are going to be pre-allocated, and through the lifetime of this table, you will have the same index with the same number of buckets, regardless of how many rows you have. So you also need to be careful in deciding how many buckets you want to have, usually between one and two times the number of rows that you have, to avoid collisions, to avoid having multiple index keys being hashed to the same bucket. So now this kind of covers very briefly how we use memory, how tables use memory. And of course, we have the basic table data. And one thing to keep in mind is that as your workload is running, it is updating and deleting and inserting rows. And there will always be some stale rows, like this one, for example. It becomes stale at some point. And because we have multi-versioning, you need to take into account that you have enough memory to cover these stale rows. Now, talking about memory management, so a few key things I want to point out. So data is always going to be in memory at all times. So all your memory optimized tables are always in memory. So this means that you need to make sure you have sufficient memory to store the memory optimized tables and also the workload to support the workload running against them. So if you don't have enough memory, if you don't provision enough memory or assign enough memory, then your workload may start failing. If it runs out of memory, if you cannot store the data anymore, you cannot insert any new rows. Your transactions will just start to fail. It's integrated with SQL Server memory management, and it does try to react to memory management as best as possible, to memory pressure, sorry, where possible. Of course, we cannot just throw away rows, but for example, we can be more aggressive in cleaning up old row versions. That's the way we react to memory pressure. Now, with the next CTP, CTP2, we will have also a decent memory management story. It will be integrated with Resource Governor, where you will be able to bind a database to a resource pool and assign a certain amount of memory to this resource pool. And then this database is not allowed to use more memory. Well, rather, the in-memory portion of the database is not allowed to use more than this assigned amount of memory. So you can, for example, assign 50% of max server memory to a particular database, and if that database fills up, all the 50% will then start to fail the transactions. But you can be sure that it will never go beyond this 50% of max server memory. This is, of course, especially important in multi-tenant scenarios. And we also have a hard limit to make sure that you don't have configuration error which can cause the server to fall over. So we will never allow your memory optimized tables to consume more than 80% of the max server memory to make sure that the server keeps running and remains stable even if there's a lot of memory pressure from the in-memory OLTP. So a couple of things to keep in mind, or a couple of things to consider. So when you consider the in-memory size, so first you think about the table data, right? the user data, the rows. You need to consider both the data, the visible data in your table, as well as the row versions you need to keep around for your workload. So it depends a lot on your workload, how much you need to keep around. If you have a very write-heavy workload, you will generate a lot of new row versions all the time, and you will have a lot of churn there, so you will need a lot of memory for that. But if you have rather a read-heavy workload, then you don't generate so many new row versions, so you might need less memory to support the workload. But to be safe, as a kind of rule of thumb, you can start with something like twice the size of the data. For the index data, the hash indexes are always fixed length. So they are always the bucket count times eight bytes for the memory pointers. The non-clustered indexes, they will be variable size. So it will depend on the size of the data, of the table, as well as the workload running on it. In terms of management, so for configuring memory, you will be able to use Resource Governor. And for monitoring, we have DMVs, Smoke can be used, as well as we have some reports in SSMS, which I will show you. Then the next point I want to address is how we free up memory, specifically old row versions. Right? You have a workload running, perhaps a write-heavy workload that keeps on generating new row versions, because every time a row gets updated, it inserts a new row version. So therefore, we have a process of garbage collection. So any update or delete or any aborted insert operation will generate a row version that will eventually become stale. that will you will probably need to keep it around for some time to be used by active transactions. But at some point, no active transactions will need the rows anymore, so you don't need them in your system. However, they still remain in your index structures, so they slow down the index scans, and also they create unused memory, so they start filling up memory more and more. So you want to reclaim this memory, of course. For that, we use a process of garbage collection. You can see this as analogous to version store cleanup, which exists for read-committed snapshots, except that, of course, we don't do the cleanup in TempDB, but in the table data structures themselves. And now to determine which rows can be deleted safely, we maintain an oldest active transaction hint. This oldest active transaction is the timestamp of the oldest running transaction in the system, and this will indicate which rows are still potentially needed. But any rows that are not valid anymore as of this point in time, they can just be removed and the memory can be freed up. So we, of course, we designed our GC system to have all the goodness like efficiency, responsiveness, scalability. Now, the one thing I particularly want to highlight here is that it is cooperative. So what do I mean by that? Well, we have, first off, we have a dedicated system thread for garbage collection. Once in a while, it goes and looks at the system, sees if there are any rows to be collected, and if so, it garbage collects them, frees up the unused memory. But in addition, active transactions help the garbage collector. So active transactions, as they are scanning the indexes, they also check for stale rows, for rows that can be removed, and remove them from the index that they are scanning. And if a row is removed from all the indexes it participates in, it can be cleaned up and the memory can be reclaimed. So it is this aspect that I want to highlight through an example on this slide. So the cooperative garbage collection. So assume you have a transaction here, transaction 4, which has a timestamp 210. So this transaction will scan through my index, and it is allowed to see all the rows that are valid as of time 210. So it is allowed to see this second row, and it's allowed to see this fourth row. So it will return only these two rows to the client, but it will still scan through these rows as well because it needs the index pointer to go to the next row. So when the transaction comes in, it will start scanning from this hash bucket. It will jump to the first row and then follow the chain of rows. Then it discovers rows in that way. Now, in this system, I have an oldest active transaction hint of 175. That means that rows that are valid at time 175, I still need to keep them around because there's some transaction may still need to read that row version. However, every row that is not valid as of time 175 can be removed. So, for example, my first row is valid between 100 and 200. So this still needs to be maintained in the system because it's still valid as of 175. However, this third row is only valid between 50 and 100. This means it can be removed. And in fact, what this transaction will now do while scanning this index, it will remove this row from the index and will reorganize the index, reorganize the pointers. As you can see, now the second row points to this fourth row. Bear in mind that this needs to be done for every index the row participates in. So the row needs to be removed from every index it participates in before the memory can be reclaimed. And my scanner here only scans this particular index, so only one index link was removed in this case. So, but a great thing here is that this offloads work from the GC thread. From the dedicated garbage collector thread, so this puts then less stress on the system as a whole. And also, in this way, the parts of the indexes that you scan regularly, they are also cleaned up regularly, which is a great advantage. But the row does need to be removed from all indexes before the memory can be freed. So ideally, if you want your garbage collection to run very efficiently, you want to make sure that all indexes are accessed frequently. So you don't have any unused indexes lying around, because it will slow down the garbage collection and will have a negative impact on your system as a whole. Okay, so now I want to show you a brief demo concerning memory. Let me see, I think I will need to log in on my laptop. There we go. As you can see, I'm squinting now because of the spotlights. So I'm sorry if I look angry. I'm not really angry at you, I'm angry at the spotlights. So let me go ahead and create my sample database. And I'm going to add my memory optimized data file group to it, as well as the container, which is always a prerequisite to create memory optimized tables. I'm going to use my database. And now I'm going to create a table. This is a pretty straightforward table: order details, which has an order ID, product ID, price, quantity, discount. Nothing special, really. And I have here three indexes. First off, I have the index for my primary key constraints, and I have two additional indexes, all type non-clustered hash. So let me go and create it. Now I can show you what my memory usage is in my database through a report in Management Studio. So there is a report, memory usage by memory optimized objects. And let me zoom this in a little bit. So we have here total usage by memory optimized objects in this database that I just created, 17 megabytes. And if you look at this chart, most of this memory is claimed by my indexes. So my hash indexes, because they are always fixed size and they are created when you create the table, they just take up this amount of space, 17 megabytes. There's a little bit of memory used by the system, this yellow here, the blue. The table does not use any memory yet, because I have not yet inserted any rows. So let me go ahead and insert a number of rows. So I'm going to insert now 1 million rows in this table. This takes a couple of seconds. And it should be done, yes. And now I'm going to refresh my report. And now you can see total usage 86 megabytes. As you can see, I now have a fair chunk of memory used by my table, 67 megabytes. Still the 17 megabytes used by my indexes. Again, these indexes don't change in size. Hash indexes are always fixed size. So the same information that I just showed, you can also access through DMVs. So if we look, for example, at this DMV, I can see here for my table, I can see the memory allocated, memory used for the table, and also the memory allocated and used by the indexes. So that is the kind of basic memory monitoring that you can do. So you can use this kind of report or this kind of DMV to monitor the memory usage in your databases or in your system as a whole. Now let's take a look at what the garbage collector is doing here in my system. So these are statistics on my indexes as they are related to garbage collection. So I have these are all the indexes for my table. So I have here my three indexes. See my index names, index IDs. And you see here scan started. Now, from the storage engine point of view, any access to an index is a scan. So even if I do like an index seek, it's always going to be a scan from the engine point of view. And in fact, I did a did a million inserts, and also an insert requires first a scan to locate where to insert exactly. So as you can see, I got here a million scans. And it happened to be the case that the engine decided to use this particular index for scanning the rows and for inserting them. Now what I'm going to do now is I'm going to delete half the rows in the table. In fact, I'm going to delete every second row. So this has completed. So I deleted now half of my rows. So I have only now 500,000 rows left. Now let's see what the index statistics have to say about this. So as you can see, I have now the engine decided to use a different index for some reason to delete these rows. Well, which could be expected, because I deleted based on the order ID value, and it is indeed the order ID index that it chose to find the rows to delete. As expected, 500,000 scans started, and also the engine returned 500,000 rows, the rows that were to be deleted. Now I want you to pay attention to these last two columns in the DMV. Well, the DMV is more, but this is just the view I am giving you. These are the rows expired and the rows expired removed. So my rows expired are the rows that are no longer valid in the system. So if I delete a row and this transaction commits, then this row is expired. And this DMV is going to report whenever an index scanner on this particular index encounters an expired row. And now, these index scanners, they don't clean up rows all the time, but they do this once in a while, because we don't want to have garbage collection put too much pressure on the system. So once in a while, they will remove the expired rows, and if this index scanner removes an expired row, then this is counted in this particular column. So, for example, if an index scanner removes a million expired rows, the number 1 million will show up in this column. Okay. So, as we could see here from this view, right after the delete, we have 500,000 scans on this row, but we did not find any expired rows. Of course, when the delete happened, no transaction had yet committed, so no rows were yet expired. But once if I now do an additional scan on these indexes, I do expect to find some expired rows. And I'm using here a count star just to make sure I scan the entire index, but I don't want any rows returned to the client because I'm not really interested in the data. I just want to see what's happening with the index scanners. So, I'm using the index hints here to ensure that I'm scanning all three indexes in this case. So let me run these. So now I scanned all three indexes. And if I look at my statistics again, you can now see that each index scanner indeed encountered 500,000 rows, 500,000 expired rows, in fact. And there were 500,000 rows were returned in this case, because there were still 500,000 valid rows to be returned by the engine to the aggregator. Now, what I'm now going to do is I'm going to run a bunch of transactions that make changes. In fact, I'm going to delete all the rows, and I'm going to execute this 10 times just to ensure that garbage collection will happen. So I executed this delete 10 times. And if I look now at the garbage collection stats, you see that this index scanner on product ID has indeed removed the rows from product ID. So apparently, this delete here always scanned the product ID index. As you can see, it encountered these expired rows a number of times. So this is always an aggregate number, but it did not remove them the first time it encountered them, but eventually it removed all 1 million of them. But they are not yet removed from these other indexes. So before the data, before the memory can be reclaimed, I need to remove them. Also, need to scan these indexes as well, such that they are removed from there, so the memory is reclaimed. And remember, if I don't reclaim the memory, there is this background thread which sweeps the dusty corners once in a while and cleans up these rows which are not cleaned up by index scanners. So don't worry about your memory use growing out of control if you don't scan every index. We do occasional sweeps. But let me just scan all the indexes once more. And now, as you can see, all 1 million rows have been removed from all of the indexes. And they encountered some of the expired rows twice, but of course they have been removed only once. So if I now, for example, execute these scans a couple of times, and you can see it's still these 1 million rows that have been removed at one point, because now all these indexes are empty and no further rows are encountered. Okay. So that concludes the memory management portion I wanted to cover. So the next thing I want to talk about is on-disk storage for durability. We really want to make sure you don't lose your data, so we keep a copy on disk, and we keep them in checkpoint files in stream-based storage, so we can load them up into memory during the database recovery as fast as possible, so you can meet your RTO. So durability for memory-optimized tables. So not all memory-optimized tables are durable and persistent on disk. You can also have non-durable tables, but the default is always going to be durable tables. But yeah, non-durable tables are also useful in some cases because they don't require any log I/O. So if you have transient data, like, for example, web sessions, and you don't really worry about losing this data when the server falls over because, for example, users can just log in again and create a new session, you can use a non-durable table, and then you will not have any I/O overhead, no logging required for those transactions. But the durable tables, we do want to persist them, and we want to persist them well. So besides being logged in the transaction log, we are also persisting the data in a single memory-optimized data file group. And important thing to keep in mind is that the access pattern for this file group is different than for your typical database data files. It's not like accessing an MDF file and writing pages willy-nilly here and there in the file. No, we use append-only stream-based storage. Now, the file group, you can have only one memory-optimized data file group in your database. However, you can have multiple containers in this file group. So you can have containers spread out over multiple disks. And this will help you in database recovery because you can load the files from all disks in parallel. So the recovery speed will happen at the aggregate speed of all your I/O subsystems. Now we use FileStream as the underlying storage mechanism, so because we use stream-based storage and we wanted to reuse the technologies which are already there. FileStream was already there, so we thought, okay, that's a good tool for us. What we did add to FileStream is we added checksums, which are not available usually in FileStream, and also error-correcting code. Now, what do these files actually look like? So, we don't have one big file, or we don't even have one file per container. No, we have a number of data files. So, rows are stored in data files, which are about 128 megabytes each. And these data files store only the rows that you insert. And they are append only. So, whenever you're inserting rows, we're just adding rows to the data file. And then we also want to keep track, of course, of the rows that you delete. So each data file is accompanied by a delta file, and this delta file contains the identifiers of the rows that have been deleted. So it identifies those rows in the data file that are no longer valid. This is kind of a representation of both files. So at the top, you see a data file, at the bottom, a delta file, and this is a checkpoint file pair, as we call it. And each checkpoint file pair has a particular transaction range. And this has to do with the commit time of the transactions that wrote the rows. So if a transaction inserts a row and commits at time 50, that row will show up in this data file. And if a later transaction comes along and deletes that row that was inserted at time 50, the identifier for that row will be written in this delta file. Now, the rows in these data and delta files, they look a bit different from the rows in memory. The row body, the row payload, column data, that all looks the same as in memory. However, the header will look a little bit different. Like, for example, we don't have a begin and end timestamp. We don't have an index ref counter, and we don't have index identifiers in the data file because they're not necessary. What we need is the timestamp of the transaction that inserted the row, well, which actually does correspond to the begin timestamp in memory. Then we have a row identifier, which is a counter within the transaction that inserted the row. So if a transaction inserts three rows, it will insert statements IDs 0, 1, and 2. So transaction timestamp and row ID together is a unique key for a row. That is the unique identifier of the row. Now, for recovery purposes, because we also want to know which table this row goes into, we also have a table identifier to identify the exact table to place it in memory. And now, a delta file contains the unique identifier for the row, so the insert timestamp, as well as the statement ID or row ID. So this uniquely identifies the row that has been deleted. And then there's also the delete timestamp, which is the transaction that deleted the row. Because you could have situations where the server crashes after the delta file has been written, but the log has not yet been flushed to disk. Well, this is rare because writes to the delta file are asynchronous, but this could happen. And then in that case, you don't want to take into account any of the transactions that are not yet persisted in the log. So therefore, we need to filter those out. They're not yet valid. So now I want to show you how we actually populate these data and delta files. So here at the bottom, you see a graphical representation of an example memory-optimized data file group. It has a number of data and delta file combinations. So the green indicates the data file, and the red indicates the delta file. And what I wanted to indicate with the height of the delta file bar here is the percentage of rows in a data file that have been deleted, that are no longer valid. And each pair has a valid transaction range. So this pair is valid between 100 and 199, this one from 200, 299, etc., and this one from 500 onwards. So this is the active one that we are currently filling up. Now, we have a thread running in the system called the offline checkpoint thread. It's offline because it does not interact directly with transactions. So this is an asynchronous process that just continuously scans the transaction log and writes rows to the checkpoint files as needed. And typically, if the checkpoint thread is keeping up, then it is scanning the log buffer in memory, so it does not need to read from disk. So this can be done pretty efficiently. And let's say in this example, we are scanning the log from left to right. So the first record we have here is a transaction, transaction one, that deletes a row. And this particular row has timestamp 150. It doesn't really matter what the timestamp is of this transaction. It matters that this row that is being deleted was inserted at time 150. Because if it was inserted at time 150, it means that this row appears in this data file, in the first data file here. So what happens, the offline checkpoint thread scans this log record, sees this delete, identifies, hey, this goes into this file pair, and it writes the identifier of this row to this particular delta file, indicating that this row is deleted. Now, if there's a log record in a disk-based table, this is skipped, of course, by the scanner because this checkpointing is only for memory-optimized tables. Then we encounter a transaction that deletes a row with timestamp 450. So because 450, the row is in this file pair here, the fourth one. So again, the offline checkpoint thread scans the log record, identifies, hey, this is a row, timestamp 450, and writes the row identifier to this delta file. Similarly, for my transaction 3, which has a row with timestamp 250, it will identify, it goes into the second pair and writes that to this data file, the delta file, not the data file. And finally, we have an insert, which will go then into the active data file. So, as such. So, what is important to keep in mind from this is that all these files are append only. So, these in particular, the data files, you keep on writing new files to the data file, and at some point this data file is closed. When it fills up, we close the data file, and then this data file is never touched again, except for merge, which I will explain in a minute. But we don't write new rows to it, we don't remove any rows from it. We rewrite the identifiers of the removed rows to the delta files. So then, of course, this brings us then to merge, because these files are append only. And, of course, we cannot just keep growing these checkpoint files, because recovery will slow down, and also your disk will fill up. So a merge operation takes two checkpoint file pairs, two data files, two delta files, and merges them together in a new pair by removing the rows from the data files that have been deleted, that have been marked in the delta files, and constructing a new data and delta file. This I covered. So, of course, benefits. You free up storage space and also improves recovery time, because during recovery time, you need to read in all the data and delta files. And if you have fewer files to load, you need less time during recovery. Also, a very important aspect here is that merge is an online background operation. So there can still be concurrent deletes going on in the transaction range of the affected file pairs. So if you're merging two file pairs between times 200 and 400, let's say, still rows that are covered by this transaction range can be deleted in the background. And we keep track of that and use that to construct a new delta file after the merge. So I want to illustrate this using an example. So we have, in this case, a bunch of checkpoint file pairs as of time 500. And we see here these two pairs, 200 to 300 and 300 to 400. The delta files are getting pretty full. So a lot of these rows have been deleted in the meantime. So ideally, you want to free up this space. So what we do is we merge these pairs into one. So we construct a new data file to reflect the rows that are in these original data files. So we have a merge operation going on. So at some point, these file pairs will be marked as under merge. So then the merge thread will work on constructing the new file pair, and we'll keep track separately of all the rows that are being deleted concurrently. So once the merge of the files physically completes, the merge thread will write a new data file. In this case, the data file covers the full transaction range of the two original files. So it's 200 to 400. Recall the original one was 200 to 300 and 300 to 400. And you can see there's a small delta file here. And this delta file comes from the rows that were deleted while these two checkpoint file pairs were under merge, while the merged files were being constructed. Then, after merge completes, these files are marked as deleted. And then there is the file stream garbage collection mechanism will then at some point kick in and actually remove the files from disk and free up the disk space. That is how merge happens. And that basically concludes the checkpointing mechanism that I wanted to cover. I want to briefly mention logging, so transaction log. So memory optimized tables use the SQL Server transaction log to log operations on the tables. And we have a special kind of log records, HK log records. Of course, this is still an artifact from the project being codenamed Hackathon. So it has a log record header, but then it has a body which is specific to memory optimized tables. The structure of these log records is completely different from the structure of other SQL Server log records. And then, important thing to keep in mind is that all logging is logical. We log only insert, update, delete operations. We do not log any physical structure modifications. We don't log any undo information, no index maintenance, nothing specific to indexes. So no log is being generated for any indexes. And we support all three recovery models. Now, a couple of considerations when thinking about storage. So, first off, because we have this append-only storage, it can happen that delta files are filling up before merge can kind of catch up and really reclaim the space. So you need to have enough headroom around to consider the delta files filling up, and you also want to have enough space for the actual merge operations going on. So in general, it depends a lot on the workload. Write-heavy workloads will require more headroom than read-heavy workloads. Rule of thumb, we recommend between 2 and 3x the size of your durable memory optimized tables. You have that much storage available at least. And you want to use an I/O subsystem that has high sequential I/O bandwidth. Random I/O is not so important for these checkpoint files because they are append only, and during recovery, they are read in memory sequentially. So you want to have good sequential I/O bandwidth. So you don't necessarily need to use SSDs. You can also have some good spinning media with good sequential I/O that should be sufficient to meet your RTO. As for the log, now log size, you can consider this as similar or sometimes less than the log for disk-based tables. It's particularly less if you have a lot of index-specific operations going on in your disk-based tables, which we don't log. But still, for the log, the key is, so we require generally a little less throughput for the log, but still latency is still remains there, right? So if you want your transactions to commit quickly, you don't want to have a lot of log I/O contention, you need to have log drives with low latency, just like any high throughput database system. So there you think of SSDs or Fusion I/O or some such thing. So backup is fully integrated in SQL Server database backup. So basically your memory optimized data file group is just backed up as part of your full database backup. It's just one of the file groups. You treat it as such. You don't really need to worry about it that much. Your existing backup scripts will mostly just work. One thing we do not support is differential backup. Also, transaction log backup will also just work as you would expect, as all memory optimized tables are simply logged in the SQL Server transaction log. One limitation that we still have in CTP1, which you may see, is that the log backup includes data and delta files. A question? If you take a differential backup, will it fail? Yes, it will fail. Take a backup. We don't do any silent ignoring of things, giving you a false sense of security. We don't want that. So we want to make it clear to you that it fails. Okay, so now I want to show you some of these storage aspects as they are related to checkpointing and logging. So let me go ahead and create my database. As you can see, in this case, I have here my memory optimized data file group as part of my create database statement. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. So you see here the memory optimized data file group is part of my create database statement. Previously, in what I showed, I did an alter database add file group, but you can also specify it as part of your create database. If you want to specify all your files when you create the database, that is the way to go. So let me run that. And then also let me create a second container here. So I'm adding a second file stream container to my memory optimized data file group. Now, in this case, I'm adding it on on the same disk because my laptop only has one drive. But typically, on your server, you want to spread out your containers over separate drives to benefit from the aggregate I/O speed during recovery. So, let me add that file group and use my database. And then, for demonstration purposes, I'm just going to create here a simple table with two columns, an integer and a character column. And I just want to quickly show you the checkpoint files that were created. So I have here my two containers. Let me zoom this in a little bit. So I have my container one and container two, and they are both file stream containers. So they have a typical layout with lots of GUIs hanging around, and we always pre-create some files. Like, this is a pre-created data file, this is a pre-created delta file, for example. Generally, you don't really need to bother with the information which is in there. The information about data and delta files is also exposed through DMVs. My second container is here. It will contain also a number of data and delta files, in this case, a couple more. We always, when creating your tables, we always pre-create a number of checkpoint files so that the checkpointing thread does not get blocked and waiting for the file system to allocate a new file. So we always allocate new files ahead of time. So for comparison purposes, let me create a disk-based table. So in this case, this table is going to be a heap. And I have one non-clustered index on this heap. And the table has the same schema as my memory optimized table. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to insert a number of rows in this table. In this case, I have 100 rows. Now, insert succeeded, okay. And now I'm going to check which records there are in the log pertaining to my particular table. And I see there are 200 log records pertaining to my table, even though I inserted only 100 rows. And as you can see, half of the inserts are in the heap, and half of the inserts are in the B-tree, in the non-clustered index, because, well, every index operation is logged here. And if we look at the aggregate size of these log records, then we see there's it's about 32 kilobytes of log generated for these inserts. Now I'm going to insert the same 100 rows in my memory optimized table. And if I now look at the log, now I don't look specifically at the log pertaining to the table, but I just look at all the log records. I have them in descending order, as you can see. So as you can see here below, these are the log records from my disk-based table, my older transaction, the commits from that transaction. But now for my memory optimized table, I only have one log record for the actual inserts, this lobhk record. And you see here the begin and commit transaction, of course, that we have for any user transaction. Now, what we can do, what I want to show you, is what this log record looks like on the inside. So we have a new function to crack these log records. Let me copy over the LSN for this log record. And I'm going to look at the insides of my log record. As you can see, we have here 102 rows. So we have, in fact, one row per insert. And we have then also a begin and end transaction for the memory optimized transaction management. And each row is 120 bytes. So this gives us an aggregate size of the aggregate size you could see from my earlier query, the size of my HK log record was about 12 kilobytes. So it's about a factor three less in this case, because the log records for the inserts themselves were about 120 bytes and not 204 in this case, and we did not need to log any specific index operations. So that is kind of basic log records for memory optimized tables. This should give you kind of an idea of the differences. Now I want to show you one more thing about checkpoint files, just to show that they do grow and how they grow a little bit. So I have here my one container. Let's see, this is my container two, and let me also open the other container. Container one. And what I now want to do is just insert a number of rows. I'm going to insert a fairly large number, about 5 million rows, to make sure that the checkpoint thread will need to allocate some new space and will need to write to some new checkpoint files. Now, as this transaction is running, actually nothing is being written to disk. The disk write only happens when the transaction commits. So we only write to the log at commit time and write then the full log record. And it's also only then that at some point the offline checkpoint thread will pick up this log record and will write the insert files to disk. So let me take a look now at my checkpoint files. Let me update this. So this is an offline thread, so therefore it is not always reliable. But there you see, there we have our transaction. So you see that the size of this checkpoint file jumped. Let me zoom this in. The size of this checkpoint file jumped from 128 megabytes to 660 megabytes. The reason is that every transaction is always in a single checkpoint file. So if the size of the transaction goes beyond the 128 megabytes, we allocate more space for that transaction, because every checkpoint file has a transaction range, so we cannot have a transaction spanning multiple checkpoints. But this should give you an idea of how the checkpoint files grow. And if I now run a checkpoint. So if I run a SQL Server checkpoint, also the offline checkpoint is synchronized with that. So also my offline checkpoint is being run, and we should see some additional files being allocated. You see there was an additional file allocated here. This because we needed to close this old checkpoint file, and therefore we needed to pre-allocate a new file. So this is kind of what checkpoint file growth is going to look like. Then there's one last thing I want to touch on, which is recovery. So during recovery, if you have memory optimized tables, what the system does for these memory optimized tables is first analyze the log to find the completed checkpoint. So we want to have a completed checkpoint to load the data. So we load these data, the data from the data and delta files, and we can use parallel load if you have multiple disks. And after this load has finished, we do a redo from the moment of the checkpoint log record until the end of the log to apply the tail of the log. This is done concurrently with the redo on disk-based tables. And as a reminder, we don't have any undo. So in this graphical depiction, I just want to show you briefly what parallel load looks like, and thereby also illustrate how the load of individual data and delta files works. So in this case, we have two containers. This one has two file pairs, this one has one file pair. The first thing we do is load the delta files into memory, and they become delta maps. They are filters for the actual data files. So then we load the data files through these filters. So we filter out the rows that are no longer valid, and the rows that are valid are being loaded into memory. And concurrently, we build the indexes along with the row inserts. And the time it takes to complete recovery on this database, at least the memory optimized portion, is roughly equivalent to the time it takes to sequentially load the data from these multiple I/O devices. And will, of course, also depend on the size of the tables themselves. Okay, so I have to recap. We have these new memory-optimized data structures, which are completely different from the data structures for disk-based tables. We have rows as the atomic unit of storage, and we have indexes existing only in memory. And they are not logged, are not written to data files. For managing memory, you need to take care that you provision enough memory for your tables and for the workload. And we will have hooks to limit the amount of memory that a particular database can use. And we have a garbage collection mechanism to collect the old rows. And you don't really need to worry about the garbage collection. The system takes care of that for you. We have persistence of durable tables to make sure your data is always recoverable. So we write to the transaction log, any transaction is logged, and we have the new checkpoint files, which are used as a persistent copy of the data to speed up recovery. And we use merge to reclaim space. And these files are all append only. I think I covered that. So related content. So this was the last breakout session on in-memory OLTP. If you want, you can revisit, rewatch the older sessions. I would recommend, especially if you have more questions about the index data structures, to watch the first part of the developer deep dive, where I go a little bit deeper into the index data structures. And I will be available after the session for any questions, and also at the Ask the Experts. Also tomorrow I will be at the booth in the Server Cloud Tools area, or whatever it's called. So resources slide, whatever. Now, please do evaluate the session. We do listen to your evaluations, always after my sessions. I always check my scores, and I always want to use your comments to improve my skills as a speaker. So, thank you, and we have now time for a couple of questions. Anybody? No? Too shy? Yes.
Is there any risk of fragmentation? You have said that writing is sequential. But is there any risk of fragmentation at any given point in time in this new structure?
The question is there risk in fragmentation? Do you mean fragmentation on disk or fragmentation in memory?
On disk.
So that would be fragmentation of the checkpoint files. Well, that will depend a bit on what your file system does, right? So if and how clean your disk is. If your disk is going to be very fragmented, then the new files we allocate are also potentially fragmented. But if you just have blocks of empty space on your disk, we can just sequentially write those. And we don't write checkpoint files in parallel. We always fill up one checkpoint file at a time on any disk. So therefore, we are not going to be a cause of your fragmentation. Only if you do bad disk management, then maybe. But no additional risk there. Yes?
Are those files zero initialized?
The question is, are those files zero initialized? No, they are not. The question is, does SQL Server need permission to do instant file initialization? I don't think we need instant file initialization per se. I mean, if you can have non-instant file initialization without zeroing out. It is only for the log that SQL Server zeros it out. Also for regular data files, SQL Server does not zero it out. But to be completely frank, I am not sure whether we use instant file initialization or not. What I know we do is that we keep on pre-allocating these files, pre-creating these files before the checkpoint thread actually needs them, so that we can be sure that the files are all already there when the checkpoint file when the checkpoint thread needs to start writing to them. Okay, so if there are no further questions, then I thank you very much, and I'm available here for any offline questions. Thank you.